This was a sort of very long road to go to bring a terrible joke I made while sleep deprived in my thesis to the fore. So I hope you enjoy it. But thanks, Katie, for the introduction, and thanks for saying my last name correctly. That's rare and few and far in between. And so I will be telling you a little bit today about particle physics and dark matter, which I sort of chose to interpret as a medieval-style bestiary of dark matter candidates, because some of these beasties are quite strange, and we have quite a lot of them. So as a little overview, I sort of envisioned this talk in three parts, not necessarily of equal length, but first we're going to talk about the standard model particles do about the, you know, particles that we see, and we're pretty confident that we see them. Then we're going to talk about the concordance model, which is sometimes also called the standard model of cosmology rather than particle physics. And dark matter, you know, a little bit about motivation. Why do we believe dark matter exists? Is it baryonic or non-baryonic, and what does that even mean? And could it be hot, warm, or cold? All of this, I promise, will make more sense in context. And then finally, we'll say something about some of the popular dark matter candidates that people are spending a lot of time working on. So said another way, we're going to talk about what we know. We're going to talk about what we know about what we don't know. And then we're going to talk about what we don't know about what we don't know. So it'll only get more mysterious as we go. But so starting with the standard model in the particle zoo, and by the way, these are all pictures from the Aberdeen bestiary that is fully published online by the University of Aberdeen. So if you want to go through and take screenshots of various animals, you can. Take a good look at the crocodiles. They don't look like crocodiles. But let us introduce then the standard model, which is something that we're relatively, you know, comfortable with, in the sense of these are particles that are all around us and we have a good idea of how they work. So for these purposes, we sort of divide them into the bosons, which are generally force carriers, and the fermions, which kind of tell us what matter is made up of. So let's start with the big kahuna, which is the Higgs boson, which was famously discovered at CERN in 2012. So this is the scalar boson that sort of gives other particles its mass, and this was sort of the crowning achievement on the standard model. This was the last piece to detect, and sort of since detecting it, we haven't progressed in the sense that there haven't been other pieces added to the standard model, and every experiment that we have keeps coming up standard model. So around it, we have four other gauge bosons. So the gamma here, it might be familiar to you as the photon, so the carrier of electromagnetic charge. So the reason you all can see me right now is because there's photons in the room with us. There's the gluons, which are greatly named because they glue together the pieces of atomic nuclei. And then the W and Z bosons, which carry weak charge. The Ws are charged, and they are named Ws for the weak force. And the Zs have zero charge, which is why they're named Zs. So those are sort of our force carrier bosons. One thing to note is that there's no gravity on here, because gravity isn't actually a part of the standard model, which drives some of us insane. And that would be really, really nice to figure out. On the matter side, I'm going to start with our quarks. So these are the up, charm, top, down, strange, and bottom. Quarks, which sort of make up some of the more complicated particles that we once upon a time maybe thought were fundamental, so things like neutrons and protons, etc. And we have a group called leptons. So we have the charged leptons, which are the electron, finally a fundamental particle that's actually fundamental, and the muon and the tau, which are sort of heavier versions of this. And then on the other side, we have neutral leptons named neutrinos, because they're small and they're neutral, and they sort of are named in parallel with the charged leptons. There's the electron neutrino, mu neutrino, and tau neutrino that have different masses. And so I made this animation, but it's very much based on one that I saw in Quantum Magazine that was in turn inspired by the film Particle Fever. So just to cite my sources. So this is a pretty complicated picture of the things that we know. And if this isn't something that you spend a lot of time thinking about, the one term that I really want to pull out of here is baryons. So baryons are a type of composite subatomic particle which contains an odd number of valence quarks and are subject to the strong force. So these are made up of gluons. However, this is a particle physicist's definition of what a baryon is. Thankfully for all of us, I'm a cosmologist, so my definition of baryon is ordinary matter. So I don't necessarily care about whether it interacts with the strong force. What I mean here is it's just normal and therefore boring. By which I mean that here, if you look at a galaxy, so if you imagine that this is something like the Milky Way, we live here. And there is something around it. So the shiny stuff here, you know, the thing that contains all of us and, you know, like this floor and this chair and everybody and everything you've ever loved, that's ordinary matter to a cosmologist or baryons. And what we're wondering is what is in this halo of dark matter that exists around this galaxy? So we are really zooming out from the standard model here and thinking about, okay, if I sort of collapse all of this into ordinary matter, all of this variety, what is the stuff that is around it? And so that is my transition into the concordance model of cosmology and dark matter. Right, so the discussion of dark matter and similarly named terms actually goes far as back as the late 19th century. It's a pretty interesting history if you care to trace it. But one of the really canonical examples that convinced us that there's something around galaxies that we can't see, but it is there and it has mass, are rotation curves of galaxies, specifically as they were presented by Vera Rubin and her collaborators. So this isn't Rubin's plot, but it is a plot similar to that one where we have two rotation curves basically that we expect from galaxies. We have the curve down here, which we expect from a galaxy without dark matter. So if all of the stuff we see is all that there is, and we have the actual points up there, which is what we observe. So there is a huge gap between the upper and the lower curve, and whatever makes up that gap, whatever answers that question, that is the thing that we call dark matter. So while this was maybe one of the earliest really convincing pieces of evidence, today one of the things that really convinces us of dark matter and maybe some of the best bounds we have on it come from this beauty right here, the cosmic microwave background, which is the earliest light in the universe that we can see. So it's not only pretty and cool that we can see this, we can actually analyze it quite well with a plot like this. So when we take all of these anisotropies, all of the blue and the yellow and the red, and plot it in terms of, say, a power spectrum on an angular scale. And so the really amazing thing that I think maybe a bunch of us know but bears repeating is that the red points here are data points, and the green behind is not a fit, it is a model. And so we know the cosmic microwave background really, really well. And so any theory that we have has to play really, really well with the cosmic microwave background because there's not a lot of room for not understanding in there. So from this plot, I will just sort of highlight two things. So, or rather, I will highlight that this theory that fits our data so well is the concordance model or the standard model of cosmology. It is sometimes talked about as a model with six parameters, but I will only care about two right now. The first is omega matter, which tells me what percentage of the stuff in the universe behaves like matter and not like dark energy or something like that. And that number is about 30%, which I get from this first peak. I can also ask it, hey, how much of the universe is normal matter, the baryons, the things that bore me as a cosmologist? And that's about 5%, which you can see in the ratio of the odd and even peaks. So if that ratio were different, then this omega B would change. So what this tells me is that of all of the stuff out there, there's much more of whatever dark matter is than whatever baryons are. So dark matter can't be answered by, hey, I forgot to count up some neutrinos, my bad. There is actually something out there that is not baryonic. Another thing to note here is that if I use the CMB and sort of set up some initial conditions and run a simulation of just dark matter evolving forward from the Z of 1100 to today, so you know 300,000 years after the Big Bang to today, I get something like this. So this is an animation by Paul Angel from the Tiamat simulation. Credit to him for the simulation and credit to Katie for showing me the simulation. And so when I run that simulation, I see something like this. This is called the cosmic web, and this is indeed what we see in data. So this is a really, really astoundingly good match to what our universe looks like when you zoom out as much as possible. And so to illuminate this, the standard model or concordance model that I've been talking about is also sometimes called lambda CDM due to its two biggest components. The first one is dark energy, which in this case I say, hey, there's some cosmological constant that is somehow related to space-time. The more space-time you have as the universe expands, the more dark energy you have beats me. You might hear more about that from the cosmology folks tomorrow, but I won't be getting into that. The thing that I'm really interested in here is the cold dark matter. That's what CDM stands for. So basically what this is a very generic description of dark matter that really reproduces this cosmic web super well. Now, the final thing to note here is why cold and what that means. When I say cold as a cosmologist, what I mean is that these particles were born in a non-relativistic regime. They're not zooming about wildly, AKA they don't have so much kinetic energy that it's hard for them to clump and form things like galaxies that we have pretty good evidence exist, right? So these are simulations by Ben Moore, for example, that show cold dark matter, which sort of forms this web similar to what you just saw. Warm dark matter, which is whatever cold dark matter is, this generic dark matter description plus some neutrinos, and then hot dark matter, which is some cold dark matter plus a bunch of neutrinos, because neutrinos move to close to relativistic speeds. And so you can see that the hotter the dark matter is, meaning the faster these particles move, the harder it is to form this web, right? This doesn't really look like a web, more so like a thread. And it's hard to form the type of galaxies that we see in this thread. So that just doesn't match. So whatever dark matter candidate we pull out has to do as well or better than cold dark matter, which is just a generic idea, or it has to be cold dark matter, but like a more precise explanation of what it's made up of, right? So that brings me to the last bit, which is our beast theory of dark matter candidates and sort of what types of beasties might make up cold dark matter or sort of alternatives to it. So one of my favorite memories from grad school is going to a conference in Rochester, New York, actually, that was sort of focused on dark matter. And so it started super optimistically. I don't remember who said this, unfortunately, but one of the organizers stepped up and was like, yeah, we've made some great progress in the dark matter field. We've really narrowed it down to about 90 orders of magnitude in mass. So to illustrate it here, these are some of the candidates that we'll talk about and some that we won't. But what we have here is from something that's like on the order of a solar mass or, you know, like many times a solar mass. So, you know, something like black holes down to super, super tiny particles to the point that they don't even behave like dark matter anymore. They start to behave like dark energy. So what I really want to emphasize here is that there is this huge parameter space to play in, right? The playground of dark matter is somehow really, really big, as long as you're able to reproduce or do better than the success of cold dark matter. And so this is what this is sort of the playground that all of us are talking to each other in and working in. So today I wanna talk about sort of four candidates. I've worked on three of the four of these. See if you can spot the odd one out. As I'm talking about them, but we will be talking about WIMPs, axions, modified gravity, and machos. By the way, I just have to say this. This thing here is an amphisbaena, a two-headed snake, which is very, very fun. And I learned about it on an episode of the Go Ask Alice podcast. So I highly recommend that if you want to learn very, very random things that you can later put into talks. But right, so let's start with WIMPs. And I've chosen to represent WIMPs with a horse here very intentionally because the expression is if you hear hoofbeats, think horses and not zebras, right? And I will explain that a little bit. So WIMPs are weakly interacting massive particles because, you know, astrophysicists shouldn't be allowed to name anything. And they are named that because they interact with gravity, right? Any dark matter candidate needs to interact with gravity and also a little bit through the weak force. And they are a miraculous prediction of supersymmetry. And so for a while, it was sort of, I think, understood, or at least that was the very common opinion, that dark matter like had to be a WIMP. It really made sense because we were really looking for supersymmetry, a version of the standard model where every force particle had its own antiparticle in the matter regime and vice versa. And sort of just by accident, such a model happens to predict a dark matter candidate like a WIMP, and it happens to predict it is just the right abundance in just about 30% of the universe. And so this has to work, right? It would be stupid if it didn't work. But it turns out we don't see supersymmetry at the LHC, at the Large Hadron Collider at CERN, and we haven't found any WIMPs. For the most part, these miraculous WIMPs that would come from supersymmetry have been ruled out, or at least the field has gotten very, very quiet. However, there is more than one way to make a WIMP. So non-miraculous WIMPs, WIMPs that are created through sort of like different scenarios are still possible and still something that people are thinking about, how to constrain with the LHC, how to constrain with astrophysics and stuff like that. So so WIMPs are still around and kicking, but the hoofbeats aren't necessarily horses. Next, I want to talk about modified gravity, which is a slightly different idea. Actually, for my joke here that I wanted to make, what I really need is a zebra. Unfortunately, I couldn't find a nice zebra in the Aberdeen bestiary. But the thing about zebras is that they're quite mundane, depending on where you live and work, right? That is also a pretty common explanation. And the question is, well, what if gravity is just different on different scales, right? Gravity was super Newtonian until we started thinking about systems like black holes and stuff, and then we had to invent GR to talk about them. So what if there's something beyond GR? What if we're sort of just halfway there and we need to go farther into the regime that we just don't live in and so don't think about? So there are many alternatives to general relativity that have been proposed. One of them is modified Newtonian dynamics, or MOND. Badumts. So this is still an active field of research. I actually just went to a testing gravity conference in January in Vancouver, but it doesn't seem super favored by the data thus far. As of right now, all of the sort of really interesting GR regimes, like pictures of the black holes with the AHT telescopes and all of our sort of gravitational waves, are coming up consistent with GR. One of the bigger issues levied at modified gravity is that it has a really hard time explaining the bullet cluster, where we sort of see that the center of mass of the dark matter and the center of mass of the baryons is not the same. And so that is one of the counterexamples to modified gravity. So it's still around, it's still possible. There could be different theories of modified gravity, not just MOND, but that is sort of the state of it as I understand it. Next, I want to talk about axions. In this case, they are presented by a unicorn because they're another popular creature with hooves. So they're somewhat miraculous themselves because they were originally actually proposed to solve a completely different problem in physics, which is the strong CP violation problem. The axions that solve this are the so-called QCD axions that have a relatively small scale in mass compared to like WIMPs, but large scale compared to other versions of axions. So there is a whole family of axion-like particles, or ALPs. They're easy to remember because ALPs slap. ALPs are awesome. If they are sort of on a mass that's larger than 10 to the minus 18 EV, they behave like cold dark matter. So they are an example of a cold dark matter, like very specific description. If they're on the order of 10 to the minus 23 to 10 to the minus 18, they behave like fuzzy dark matter, which is slightly different than cold dark matter. But sort of similar on large scales, which is the bit that we like. And even at a mass of 10 to the minus 33 EV, which is so, so small that it's bonkers to even imagine, they even behave like dark energy. So they are also interesting because sort of if you have these different axions of different masses, you can maybe explain two for one phenomena. So axions have definitely gotten more and more popular. And finally, I want to talk about machos. What if the hoofs are really, really big? Basically, machos, other than being, you know, a great village people joke, are massive compact halo objects, which basically says, you know, what if it's not something super exotic or new? What if it's just a bunch of these things that we already know exist, but there's more of them and we can't quite see them? So things like black holes and neutron stars and dwarfs have been, red dwarfs, I believe, have been suggested in the past. The issue, of course, is that these are baryonic, and we can't have that many baryons accounting for it. So one non-baryonic idea is primordial black holes that became really, really popular around the first LIGO detection, because there was a lot of question of whether these gravitational waves that we're seeing are from primordial black holes or sort of stellar mass black holes. So these have been fairly constrained. They're still possible. They can still make up all of dark matter, but with a very, very specific mass range to the point that it kind of becomes close to fine tuning. Like, you need somewhat of a miracle here as well to make it happen. However, we're looking forward to LISA, which should launch in 2034, if everything goes on time, to get more answers on that. So they are still very much kicking and in the game. Finally, I just want to name a couple of other BCs that exist there. I haven't worked on these, and in fact, some of these I sort of looked into for the first time last night. But I just want to sort of, again, underscore the creativity that goes into this field, because there's something like atomic dark matter, where you sort of think of a dark standard model where you have a system of atomic-like bound states, suggesting the same way that this is made up of atoms, maybe dark matter is made up of bound states of dark atoms. Gravy balls, I think, is a thing that I heard for the first time, which is a system of gravitons bound together by their self-interaction. So that's another interesting one. And then self-interacting dark matter is actually a fairly popular one that I've been hearing about, which is kind of like cold dark matter, but in addition to interacting with gravity, you have some self-interactions. And so this is a very active field of research as well. Sorry?
How is that different from the other two?
So it's not necessarily, so self-interacting dark matter doesn't necessarily say that it's bound gravitons or that it's sort of like a whole system of bound states. It just says, imagine a particle. And when I write down the Lagrangian with that particle, it has like a term that not only interacts with the gravity, there is also some self-interaction term where they interact with themselves. So I guess you could say that gravity balls are sort of self, there's self-interaction twice on this slide. So you can say that the gravity balls are sort of self-interacting dark matter because they interact with themselves, but they're a much more specific version of it. So this is a much more generic idea, if you like. Sorry, yes.
Can I talk about self-interaction versus like collisionless, like with the bullet cluster?
Ah, sure. Right. So we generally think of cold dark matter as a bunch of collisionless particles, and that's the idea of a bullet cluster. Is then when you have two things that collide, they can sort of like move through each other as necessary. So the self-interactions might sort of put an addendum on that collisionlessness because you're sort of interacting with yourself, but you're also interacting with yourself in like two dark matter particles do see each other gravitationally. They just also see each other through self-interaction. So they might put an asterisk on it, but it doesn't necessarily negate it. Yes?
By self-interaction, do you mean like it interacting with its own field or interacting with the field of the thing it's bound with?
I see. I believe it's interacting with its own field, but I haven't actually worked on self-interacting dark matter.
Yeah, there's usually. Like,
do you have an addendum?
Yeah, there's usually like a fifth force. Like there's some kind of mediating force. There's some kind of mediator in the dark sector that where the dark particles can have an interaction through a new force between them, so that when the dark matter particles collide, they interact through something that's not gravity and not one of the standard forces.
I wonder if it does fit in your classification or is out. My own preferred candidate, which is long living remnants after the end of the evaporation of a molecule black hole. That's a black mass.
Yeah, so I guess it wouldn't be a macho because it's not a massive compact halo object. Like a massive compact halo object is really like, what if not particle, what if particle, right? And so I don't think that those would be...
It's big for you.
So machos have to be kind of big, is my guess.
Like here. Is that big for you?
No. A black hole is big for me.
No, a black hole can be small. That's a black hole.
Yeah. Yeah, it can be small, but the issue with black holes that are too small is that they do Hawking evaporate, so you sort of have to have a minimum mass to be long-lived, because the other thing that we need for dark matter is we sort of need it to be around from the very beginning for the universe to evolve as we think it is. Sorry?
It's a remnant. It's end.
So you're suggesting...
It needs to evaporate, Carlo, and that's why they are nicer. So if you have a bouncing cosmology with the black holes formed in a three-bound space, then you have these remnants that are absolutely wonderful.
Of course. I haven't thought about them specifically. I'd be happy to chat to you more, but I can't say that I'm an expert.
So this is, and I claim that this is really a question. It's not. So like,
okay.
My understanding of this question is that it's not going to be an answer. But this is for everybody. So one of the things that I'm glad to present, it's a beautiful talk. One of the things that I really like how you presented this wide range of masses that can explain the same, the same data. And what reminded me of, this was first time I saw this, is when we see degeneracy in quantum mechanics. Have the same energy state if I move things around, right? So clearly what you would want to do is to break that degeneracy.
Yeah.
And of course it's hard to do, right? But clearly y'all have been thinking about how to break that degeneracy.
And so is the question, how do we break that degeneracy?
How do we break the degeneracy?
Right. So I guess you've sort of...
Another question.
No, that is absolutely the million-dollar question, or whatever the Nobel Prize money is these days. Right, so you kind of got in front of me a little bit, because I was actually going to complicate it by introducing another potential degeneracy. So can I maybe just delay answering your question just a little bit, and then we can talk about it at the end?
Okay, keep going, sorry, my
bad. And there's just like a couple of concluding slides. But one thing, I wanted to introduce one idea that I, and certainly not just myself, have been thinking about recently. Which is, okay, so conclusion and summary. Right, so I'll just do my spiel and then we'll get to that. But anyway, so the summary basically is that in terms of matter, right, because I'm choosing not to care about dark energy right now, what the universe consists of is around 5% of all of these, sort of this richness of particles that sort of interact and you know, evolve in interesting ways, and around 25% of question mark. And that question mark has to either be cold dark matter or do as good or better as cold dark matter, by which I mean that it has to reproduce that beautiful sort of large scale cosmic web, but also it has to work on, you know, on every single scale. So a few things to note here: that we have a huge parameter space to search, right? So, you know, of the order of 80 masses, right? And there are a variety of possible explanations, both quantitatively and qualitatively, right? There's a range of masses for every particle, but there's also just so many ways to think about this, including ways that aren't particles at all. And there's no obvious best candidate right now. Of the four that I showed you, each of them have some pros and cons to them, but not one of them is perfect. And so what I just want to emphasize here is that this open boundedness just leaves so much room for creativity. It's a very creative and dynamic field. And also, I want to underscore that the universe doesn't actually owe us a simple explanation. And so there have been people that have been thinking about, myself very much included, of could dark matter actually be a dark sector? So some of these candidates that I presented have hinted at this. But if we have this beautiful wheel of standard model particles to explain these forces, could there, or, you know, and luminous matter as we see it, could there be something like really complicated in the dark sector? So in that case, what if I had axions and WIMPs and primordial black holes, right? And so that further complicates your question of there's even more degeneracy, because what I really know is that about 20% of the universe is dark matter, but I don't know what the subdivisions within that are, or if indeed they exist.
So you call it the dark jungle.
The dark jungle, there we go. Yes, absolutely. And so another thing to note is that we may or may not, time will only tell, be seeing some cracks in the CDM model. So some of you might have seen about JWST and some really early, really big, really shiny halos that aren't predicted by cold dark matter, which, you know, time will tell how much of this is sort of a data question and how much of this is like, hey, the theory is wrong. But if the theory is wrong, that's really exciting, because the cracks are where you get to find out something new. And one more thing that I want to underscore is that the thing that we might need to focus on as a field is how dark matter and baryons interact, especially on small scales. Because a lot of the time, you're either thinking about the astrophysics of what happens in a galaxy, or you're thinking about the dark matter halo. And putting those two things together is challenging, both from a theoretical perspective, because there's so much messy astrophysics that you need to think about, but also just from a computational perspective of these things take a lot of memory and computing time. And so, right, that is kind of what I wanted to leave you with. Yeah, and thank you, I'll take it. And yeah, ask me questions, find me in the hallways, chat to me, or if you have extra questions that I don't get to, there's a dying website and also my email. Yeah.
Thank you, it's great to talk. One thing that's always confused me, and I'm sure it's really elementary, maybe you can just clear it up for me. Is weakly interacting with particles, right? Weakly interacting, there has to be some weakly interacting.
Yeah.
What if they just didn't weakly interact? What if they were just massive?
Oh,
I mean, why did they put the weakly interacting in there?
Right, it would be really, really convenient for us if dark matter interacted with something in addition to gravity, because then we could look at it for it at the LHC, or at something like the LHC. Like I said, they were really, really beloved because they sort of accidentally fell out of this supersymmetric theory, which, you know, like, I really want the universe to be supersymmetric. Symmetry is nice. I want, you know, like, it really annoys me that there are four gauge bosons and one of them isn't a carrier of gravity. Like, that's stupid. Why do we design it that way? But that's the way that it is. And so there's sort of a model of, one, it fell out of supersymmetry, but also you need the Hail Mary because that's how you have a prayer of detecting it. Because if you don't, then it gets harder. It's not impossible, mind you, but then maybe you have to think about astrophysical symptoms rather than looking for it at something like a particle collider. Does that make sense?
Yeah, so basically we hope it's weakly interacting because otherwise we're screwed.
Right, so axions as well, there are different theories and you can sort of have different extensions, but so axions, especially the QCD axion, might very weakly interact with like ENM fields. And so there's this like type of detector called a haloscope, which basically has a really big magnetic field and sort of hopes that an axion will come through and every once in a blue moon interact with it and, you know, like show you an anomalous particle that you didn't, you know, an electron came out of nowhere or a photon or whatever it is at like right the right energy. So there's an element of hope and there's an element of like, well, this is what we can do. So let's chip away at this part of the vast, vast parameter space and try to break that degeneracy a little bit more. Sorry, go ahead.
Can I ask this something?
Yeah, please.
So that's the main thing. There's also an element of like, it's possible but not easy to make dark matter appear in the universe in the first place without having any particle interactions. So like a weak interaction is a natural way to do it. Axions are a natural way to do it. Unfortunately, and we're very upset about this, there are theorists who have come up with ways for dark matter to exist in the universe without having any interaction other than gravity. I really wish they had not done that. So it may be that there are no particle interactions at all, that it's just gravity. But we hope not.
Okay, let's go this way and then back.
Just a comment, since this is we're talking about science. I love the way you present things.
Thank you.
In a very sort of honest way. There's one detail which I disliked, which has nothing to do with dark matter, but I want to voice it out because it's something that comes out with. It's not somehow you mentioned because everybody says so. I know everybody says so, but I think it's a very bad in my opinion. 4 plus 25 is 30%.
Mm-hmm.
The rest, of course, is dark energy.
Yeah.
I think that calling dark energy a component of the universe, a mysterious substance that we don't know what it is, it's bad science popularization. It's very misleading. I know that everybody does that. I know that it's all the but I think it's very bad because we don't know what it is. But in the model you're presenting, it's just terms in an equation, which mathematically, you can put in a balance of things, and then you can call it substance. But it's not substance in any sense. So this thing that there is a mysterious dark matter, which we don't know that it is, it's real, it's doing real science, and look, there's a mystery here. But the other one, there's a mysterious dark energy, we don't know what it is. We have an equation that works, and there are speculations that might be something else. So dark energy and dark matter are so profoundly different. That's the problem. That putting them as equal mysteries seems to be making
But if Mond is right, then there isn't dark matter either.
Sorry?
If Mond is right, then there's no dark matter either.
No, they are conceptually very different. You're presenting a modeling that is called lambda CDM. Mm. What they call the dark energy is lambda. So it's already in the equation. Mond implies the modifications of our theories. So lambda is not the modifications of our theories, but Einstein had since the beginning.
So you don't have to modify the theory, it's just the Einstein theory with lambda, it's written in 1917. It does exactly this phenomenology of without any mystery. There are open questions there. I'm not saying that there are no open questions. It's an interesting thing to investigate. But I think it's wrong to say there's a big mystery of this substance that fills the universe, 70% or whatever of it, which is dark.
I see what you're saying. It makes it sort of sound like the luminiferous ether.
You can write it. You can put it on either side of the Einstein equation, right? So like, you can represent it as something that has an energy density. That's an effective theory that's not necessarily.
But that's just stuff.
Well, if it has an energy density. mean, it might be a scalar field.
What's the stuff here? There's an energy density because I throw it. I have created more stuff.
I mean, if you think of it as a scalar field, then that's just something that has an energy density. And if you put it in the stress energy sensor, why do you want it in the stress energy sensor? It's just some field or something.
Yeah. So you're making believe that there is something else.
There might be a field.
Something is to speculate there might be something else. Something to say there's a big mystery out there.
I don't think we know
what is 70% of the stuff in the universe.
We don't know what is dark matter.
That's true.
No, that's true. I think it's unreasonable to represent it as this is possibly a kind of stuff. And it's clear we don't know what it is. We don't know if it's a kind of stuff.
Everything is possible. It could also be little dragons flying around. But something is what it might be. Something is whether it's a mystery or not. I think it's important when we do popular science to not mix our speculations. It might be something else, fine. But might be something else, not a mystery. And we have an equation that describes very well the world perfectly, but not dark matter. That's what we have. Mm-hmm. And perfectly well, what is called dark energy, namely the acceleration, essentially. So they're very different philosophically, scientifically.
But Carla, the ratio is important to think about because you know, the idea is we currently live in this special time when the ratios are comparable to order of magnitude. So
we don't live in a special time. If this special time is 95% of the time of my time, so far.
Because you think logarithmically,
maybe we can continue this conversation.
There's a coffee break after this, so
let's continue with the coffee break. But there's still a few more minutes for questions. So I thought there were two more hands here that I saw first. Super quick one is, how do the tiny, tiny axions look like dark energy?
That's a good question. Let's see. So I don't actually study the super tiny ones that look like dark energy. So I don't have the best answer for you. But what I do study are the slightly less tiny ones that look like fuzzy dark matter. And so because they're so tiny, their de Broglie wavelength is on the order of a kiloparsec. So they're this really interesting case because they're not quantum, it's a classical system, but you start to use this sort of quantum language to describe a really big, really classical system, which I find interesting. And so I imagine it has to do with the fact that the further down you go, the larger the de Broglie wavelength gets.
Maintain some kind of density.
Yeah, and so you wash out all structure inside that de Broglie wavelength. So I imagine it has to do with something like, you know, bubbles inside of the de Broglie wavelength or something like that. But this is speculation. I'd have to look it up and get back to you. That's a question I should have anticipated. Sorry, Blue Turtleneck, I think I owe you a question.
Hi.
Sorry, I don't see your name.
Katrina.
Hey, Katrina, yeah.
Argument aside.
Yeah.
I've always been confused, even as a physics student, between the 30% and the 5%. What are those things referenced? I hear people say it's 95% of the universe versus, it's like 75%, you know, and I don't understand,
Right. So, you know, there's a couple of pie charts floating around that are sort of subsidiaries of one another. And I actually had this slide in another talk, but I didn't put it in here. So this is the, all the stuff. Mysterious or otherwise, this is all of the energy density that you have to have in the universe to sort of make a flat universe, which we have pretty good reason to suspect that we live in. So we know that about 70% of it is this cosmological constant, or lambda, and 30% of it is something that scales as matter. And you know, some small sliver of it is radiation, but it's like sub a percent or something like that. It's basically not worth talking about at this cosmological time. And so when you zoom into this one, you can either subdivide this into 5% of this, or 5% of the whole shebang is baryons, and 25% of it is dark matter, whatever dark matter is. Or you can zoom in and say, okay, so this is all of the matter in my universe, so all the stuff that scales like matter. And 20% of that, I might be doing some quick and fast math here. So 20% of that is baryons or regular matter, and the rest of this is dark matter. So you can say that, you know, there's about six times The baryons is the amount of dark matter that you have.
It's an equation we all understand.
Yeah.
So 70% is dark energy.
Yeah, so this is like of all of the stuff that we need for the universe to move and expand the way that all of our data says that it moves and expands. And then if you say, you know, mysterious or not, I don't know, I personally find dark energy not as exciting as dark matter because, and don't crucify, some people find it very exciting, that's totally fine. But to me, that's like, oh, this is something that's in trend, I don't know, in my mind, it's like some sort of constant, right? It comes free with space. If you buy 1 meter cubed of space, you come with 1 meter cubed of the cosmological constant. And so it's dark energy, you know, the story is it's dark energy, darks because we don't know what it is, and energy so we can ask the DOE for money in the United States, right? And so in some sense, it's not as dynamic and interesting to me, which is why we focus on this bit. Sorry, so that was a little bit of propaganda. Okay, you then you.
I'm surprised to see, I mean, maybe I'm misinterpreting what you said, but I was surprised to see, like, Mon sort of on an equal footing in your talk with some of the other things.
So you've guessed the one that I haven't worked on.
I mean, Mon can't do the CMB, right?
Oh, actually, as of 2 years ago, it can.
Are you kidding me?
It's still, yeah, so I had to go looking because I know very little about Mond, actually. But so as 2 years ago, or 2021, when was that? I guess 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, there was this sort of modified theory of Mond that is actually able to reproduce the CMB for the first time, which is, I think, exciting, but it still can't reproduce the bullet cluster, which is, where's my mouse? So there's a video here from the Chandra X-ray Observatory, which is hopefully running. Yeah. Okay. So it shows you in optical where we see the X-ray gas, and then also where we see the dark matter is from sort of the lensing. And so you see how the red and the blue don't intersect. So as of a couple of years ago, Mond can explain the CMB, or at least some versions of Mond can explain the CMB, but still can't explain the bullet cluster. So I presented it again in sort of the context of what we need is creative thinking, right? Because the parameter space is so large. But I personally haven't worked on Mond, and I can't say that I'm a big believer in Mond. But in dark matter, we all kind of live in glass houses when it comes to our favorite candidates, and so I'm not about to start throwing stones.
Yeah, this is a relativistic Mond, or is it not?
Yeah, it's relativistic Mond.
But it's the one where they make up a field that acts just like a dark matter particle, and they're like, oh, it's just another field.
Yeah, I skimmed it because I also thought, like, hey, I don't think this can do the CMB. And so it can, but there's, you know, some stuff under the hood that is maybe a little bit suspect.
I said to you a little clarifying question. So the cosmic web kind of visualization of simulations, is that fairly quantitative? Like, are they looking at, like, actual details of, like, the size of the filaments and, like, the density and those sorts of things? Or is it much more just like, hey, this kind of looks like that?
Katie's shaking her head.
Yeah, it's statistically indistinguishable.
Yeah.
Okay. And at the right scale.
Yeah. Yeah. So if you super zoom in, I think, on small scales, you can start to... There's an argument on whether there is or is not a small-scale crisis in cosmology. Some of the small-scale crisis is fixed by adding, you know, galaxies or, like, baryons, but some of them aren't. So that's still a conversation.
My other question was, could you talk about, like, dark sectors that might be any number of things, but is there, like, fully dark and potentially have their own dynamics, whether it's standard model-like or other? Presumably, is it true that... You have to have at least something that's not standard model-like in order to have, like, the halos be bigger than, like, if you just took a carbon copy of the standard
model. Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So when I say dark sector, which is, by the way, a term that I picked up from Chanda Prescott Weinstein, but I don't know where it originates from before that. But when I say dark sector, I mean, what if not one dark matter, what if more dark matter? And so that can be as complicated or as simple as you want. So one of the things that I'm currently thinking about is an axiverse scenario, which is basically if you employ the right string theory arguments, which I'm completely unable to employ but will benefit from anyway, if you're going to make one type of axion, you might as well make a bunch of types of axions. And so you might have these dark energy axions sliding around, but you also might have these dark matter axions. And so then no single mass of axion, no single flavor of the field is making up all of dark matter, but if you add it up, you get dark matter, and that's much more unconstrained. And so I think that's interesting because I kind of think, I've also worked on primordial black holes, not the DM candidates, but a slightly different population. But I think they're interesting. I kind of see them as something that absolutely may or may not exist. There's a good explanation of why it could exist. That doesn't mean it does exist. That's not necessarily the universe that we live in. But I would not be surprised to hear that we found some primordial black holes and there's some part of this dark matter, but not 100% of the dark matter. Because if you think about it, neutrinos are kind of dark matter. They're hot dark matter. We don't have enough of them to make up everything, but they sort of behave like dark matter. So that's what I mean when I say dark sector. Like, what if we sort of widen our scope a little bit? I've lost the plot of who raised their hand when, so maybe you and then you.
Oh, okay. I was very surprised that you were talking about the balance, possible balance on different species of dark matter contributing to the total balance.
Mm-hmm.
In the past, I heard a theorist saying that there were arguments for which there should have been only one species. What have changed? I didn't understand what was the argument, so can you tell us what it was and what changed it?
Yeah, that's a good question. So like I said, I've only started thinking about this recently, and so I don't know if this has actually happened recently or if I've started paying attention recently, but there are a lot of proponents very much for this and very much against this. And the argument against, or at least the argument that I hear the most is, well, if you have, if you have three species of particle, let's say, type of dark matter particle, aren't they all going to decay into the lowest mass one? Because that's going to be the one that's most stable. So the argument is I guess it could be a parallel to see a lot of neutrinos. You don't see a lot of taus and muons unless you're smashing hadrons, in Geneva. Or in any other particle collider. And so that is an argument. I don't have an anti-argument of no, that's not true. That is true. However, I think that we've sort of been driven to the point that all of the reasonable things are slowly being ruled out. And so I am a proponent of, well, let's think creatively in the same way that, JWST optic, or the things that people have learned through implementing JWST optics for the telescope are now being used to better LASIK surgeries. And so I think even if we come up with the wildest dark matter candidate that could never work, that doesn't mean that we won't learn something from that that will lead us to a better idea. So I'm sort of, that might be true, but I'm not mad at it either way.
You said that you're working on axions mostly.
Yes,
so
right
I'm
now.
I'm an observer, so I'm always thinking, how are we going to get evidence for this?
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that would come from particle physics, from colliders, or is it going to come astrophysically? And then I guess the follow-up question is, how much astrophysical evidence do you think we can actually collect? Or is it always just going to be we need the particle physics evidence to solve, to crack this mystery?
Okay.
For me, I'm I feel like we have enough evidence to be yeah, dark matter exists, cool. Do we need to know what it's made of?
I don't know. I would.
yes.
I'm okay. So depending on which one of these you look at, let's look at this pie chart, right? Of just the matter in the world. Because like I said, I don't super care about dark energy. I'm really annoyed that I don't know what 80% of the things out there are. I don't know if that's a good argument, but I will always want to know because it'll always be annoying to me that we're so dwarfed by that we're so dwarfed by it and we have no idea. So depending on the exact particle that you're thinking about, there's mostly sort of a complementarity of sort of astrophysical approaches and particle physics approaches. So for the axions in particular, most of these halascopes and other types of experiments are looking for either the QCD axion or the slightly more massive axions on that scale. If you get down to what I'm thinking about, the 10 to the minus 22 EV, which, by the way, my favorite factoid is that if you compare that mass to the mass of an electron, that's equivalent to comparing the mass of an electron to a mass of a tennis ball. So it's extremely small. Those generally wouldn't show up in detectors because they're smeared over too big of a surface or they interact too weakly. And so there you're really looking at astrophysics. And I come from an astro background, and so I'm always a little bit more interested in that side because that's just the roots from which I sort of sprung up. So things that have been used to put bounds on this or think about this are sort of dwarf galaxies and stellar streams, sort of because fuzzy dark matter, the one that I study, would come with a little bit of extra heating. You can sort of use Gaia and stuff to put some bounds on it. But on the other hand, if you look at sort of these new JWST halos that are super big and super shiny in the early universe? Well, yes, yes, yes. So it could be that it's just nothing, right? But I choose to believe that it's something because that's more interesting. And then if I'm proven wrong, well, at least they publish some papers. So in that case, fuzzy dark matter can actually help because it actually produces preferentially larger halos because it cuts off the smaller size halos because they're below that de Broglie wavelength. So for most of these, you'll have a complementarity of approaches. Every so often, you'll find one that is really much more suited to one or the other. But I think if we detect an axion, any axion, you know, it doesn't have to be a dark matter axion. There is talk about solar, looking for solar axions, which would be sort of produced in the nuclear processes of the sun in things like xenon-1T. Like, I would be so excited. Because if you find any axion, it opens the door to more. And I really want to see them more. Yes?
At the beginning, you mentioned Vera Rubin as the one who noticed the galaxy rotation issues. That is Vera Rubin Observatory?
Yeah.
Is it made to help answer some of these questions?
Ish. I mean, it's not going to hurt, but I don't think it's... No. It's not... I lose track. Vera Rubin is LSST, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. So it's certainly going to help, but it's not sort of it's not quite parallel in the same way. I think it's just honoring someone that should have been honored, in my opinion, a long time ago, as should have many people in this field and pushed out of this field.
If you could look into the future 10 years and get the results of only one experiment or one experimental program or one observational program, which would you pick?
I think I would pick one of the gravitational waves one. So I wouldn't pick LISA because if I look 10 years in the future, LISA just will not have launched, which is a little bit annoying. So ask me again in like 2-3 years. But I don't know, I'm interested in what will be coming out of the pulsar timing array in terms of sort of background gravitational wave sources and things like that, like a stochastic background. I think gravitational waves are super, super cool. One of the reason I really like them is because unlike light, you know, unlike photons, they allow us to see past the CMB. The CMB is really great, and it's a really great picture of our universe in our infancy, but I actually am interested in what's happening way, way earlier. So to me, it's almost an annoyance that is in the way of what I want to see, and gravitational waves can surpass that. So right now, we're not really expecting, there's a limited number of signals that we're expecting from like this immediately post-inflationary universe, but I would really love to see anything that comes out of that.
And those would be good for like nanograv type?
Also yeah.
One believes in inflation. What is the idea that after this, and if dark matter is one of these things that you said, is the idea that it gets excited like the rest of the matter after the inflation came down?
Is the question how is inflation connected to some of these dark matter candidates? It depends. So some of them are produced sort of like through couplings with the inflaton field. Some of them are produced, you know, immediately pre or before inflation. My obsession with inflation is sort of somewhat tied to dark matter in that depending on which candidate you look at, it could actually be telling. But also, I just think inflation is really, really cool. I think it's really... You know, I remember the first time that I learned about inflation, and the idea was like, well, there was, you know, we think that this is how it happened. There was this, you know, particle called the inflaton, which basically like caused the universe to expand super, super rapidly, and then suddenly it decayed and it was never seen from again. And I think it's wild that there could be a dinosaur particle out there and we're looking for its bones. And so I would really like to see the bones of the dinosaur particle, please.
You know, the pattern of, you know, dark matter models, Katie's very familiar with this, is that you had, well, including the axion, problems in the standard model, meaning the standard particle physics, and then you have coincidentally solutions to those problems, like a hierarchy problem, and yada yada, strong CP problem, and they have these things, these entities that solve those problems in the standard model in collider physics, have the properties, the stability, and the, you know, all that stuff, witness of dark matter. So, like, you know, in that chart that you showed me there, of course, there's a small percentage of those. So full disclosure, I work on inflation and dark matter production. So one question I'm going to throw out there is, given those candidates that do address problems having to do with the standard model, people today, so given those problems, is there anything, the universe doesn't have to obey Occam's razor, if we invoke optimization, that pattern of looking at problems in particle physics, it has the right property dogma. Since we mentioned inflation, are you aware of any other models of that form that would,
of a
dark matter candidate that actually addresses another problem that has nothing to do with dark matter?
So, sorry, are you asking me, am I aware of other dark matter candidates that sort of solve another problem simultaneously, or am I aware of alternatives to inflation that solve that problem?
Not alternatives to inflation. So the ask is, we know that there are unresolved problems in the standard model of particle physics. There's a host of them. Like, for example, I'll name one, baryogenesis.
Yeah.
And in fact, I'm thinking about baryogenesis. I'm saying, let's consider the baryogenesis problem. Can dark matter be tied to that? Of course, the answer is yes. That's the David Kaplan, right? He wrote, asymmetric dark matter. That was an example.
I was actually just talking to somebody about asymmetric dark matter at lunch.
And so, the idea there is very simple. It's, the matter in our universe, there's way more matter than antimatter. It's, so it had to be produced by something like inflation or the decay of inflation. So the idea is that can the same mechanism that's doing that, whatever that is, do it for dark matter. So there's a cogenesis of dark matter and baryonic matter, and they're really just mirrors of each other. So there really is no asymmetry, right? It's just that the antiparticle, in some sense, of baryonic matter is actually the dark matter. And that's why you have that ratio that one is five times the other.
Yeah.
So that's an old idea. That's not my idea. This is, So what are your thoughts about that?
What are my thoughts about that specific one or about similar?
No, general class of ideas.
I mean, I think it's great to get a two for one. And, another argument against, sort of a dark sector is that, we're not trying to invent a bunch of other things that, we have sort of tenuous evidence for, that, simpler is better. So that, that is the invoking of Occam's razor. And so I think that it sort of depends on how you define simplicity. Again, in the Axiverse scenario, if you have enough sort of these ultra-ultralight axions that could be dark energy, and you have, a range of axions that could then constitute dark matter and potentially solve the CP problem, like, great, you're golden. So I think that those are definitely some of the more compelling examples to work on. And, if we're sort of prioritizing, of that enormous parameter space, which part are we going to chip away at first? I want to chip away at those first, because those are the ones that I'm most excited about. So I think that's definitely a good plan, but I also think that, the community is large enough that I think a diversity of ideas is never a bad thing.
So it's 4:05.
Oh, sorry.
We have a coffee break next. So why don't we thank Luna again, and then we'll head down to the first meeting.
Thanks, everyone.